Good morning, everyone. I'm calling to order the February 27, 2023 Senior Citizen Engagement Committee meeting. Jim, would you please lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance?
Yes. Would everyone please stand? I pledge allegiance to the flag
of the United States of America.
And to the republic, which is one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you, Jim. Elizabeth, would you do the roll call, please?
John, I don't see Elizabeth here this morning. Would you like me to go ahead and do that for you?
That'd be great. Thanks, Desiree.
Tony Alabato.
I'm here.
Elizabeth Busick. Colette Chinsinski. I see Colette there. Thank you, Colette. Meredith Chalemi. Scott Feig. Elaine Genoway.
Present.
Ken Higman.
Here.
Sherry Horn.
Here.
Jim Levy.
Present.
John.
Look, I'm going to turn it down.
Tony Rodella.
Tony was here. Tony, did you hear your name?
Oh, called? I see you there, Tony.
Yes.
Thank you. Dave Tetzloff.
Dave is absent.
Evelyn Velez. And we do have quorum, Chair.
Great, thank you. Okay. I don't have anything to add in terms of introductions. Desiree, do we have any one from the public?
We did not receive any requests to speak in advance. If there are members of the public present this morning that would like to address the committee, please use the hand raise icon or press star 9 and I will unmute you. Seeing no hands, Chair.
Thank you. That allows us to move to today's presentation. I understand we're going to have also George Dixon, but first we're going to introduce Karen Rossi from the Council on Aging, who will present on elder abuse prevention. Then we'll be followed by George Dixon, VSO of the Orange County Veterans Service Office, who will present on elder veterans services. With that, I'd like to introduce Karen Rossi and ask Karen to begin her presentation. Karen?
Thank you, John. I need to share my screen. I'm not seeing where I can do that though.
Should be the green button. Do you on the bottom?
Oh, I'm sorry. I gotcha.
Perfect.
They all are different. Okay, share screen. Why am I not finding my presentation? There we go.
Karen,
Karen, before you start,
Desiree, did you see that Elizabeth has joined us?
Yes, I got her marked down. Okay, thank you.
Great, thank you. Sorry, Karen.
Oh, not a problem at all. Let's see. I am trying to do that. All right, are you seeing the full screen or are you also seeing the sides?
Sides.
Okay, I'm trying to get it out from under the top. I'm not able to see.
On the top orange ribbon, if you see the little kind of screen with the play button in it on the left side.
Yeah, the problem is I've got this other thing over the top of it. I've got a black border over the top of it, which I haven't seen before. And I can't see underneath it.
Maybe minimize your screen temporarily, the PowerPoint, yeah.
Up, there we go. Nope, didn't. Hang on, it's gonna work from beginning. There we go. Can everybody hear that? All righty. As John said, I'm Karen Rossi. I'm with the Council on Aging, and I'm with a program called the Senior Protection Program. And today we're gonna talk about the anatomy of a scam. We're gonna talk about the four main red flags that each of us should be aware of to help protect us and protect our loved ones from elder financial abuse. The first thing we're gonna talk about will be some of the programs and services that are available at the Council on Aging. Some of you may already be familiar with us. We'll talk about the older adult population in Orange County, how it's changing and how that impacts the incidence of elder financial abuse. We'll talk about the anatomy of a scam, the four common elements of every scam. Then we'll talk about some of the more common scams that are out there. We'll talk specifically about cybercrime. What is it? How do we protect ourselves from it? How do we know when we're seeing it? Then we'll talk about what makes those of us who are older vulnerable to scams. Why are we vulnerable? What happens? How is it that we are so easily taken in? And then we'll talk about if you're caring for someone or you're around someone, what are the flags that you would want to be aware of, that some obvious and not obvious, to help you understand if something might be going on with that individual? So the Council on Aging, we have 290,000 seniors that we serve on a regular basis every year. We have about 80 full-time employees, so we are very, very heavily volunteer-driven. $4.6 million in revenue, majority coming from the federal government, state government grants, and then the balance coming from individuals, foundations, and various corporations. We have seven main programs. Some of you may already be familiar with us. I'll run through them very quickly. The Ombudsman Program, we are a state-mandated ombudsman site for five different counties out of Orange County. And what an ombudsman is a person who is responsible for advocating for anyone who is a resident of a licensed facility. And that means that if there's something happening in that facility, the family doesn't think something is right. The individual feels like something is not right. Someone in the facility feels like the resident might be being taken advantage by somebody. The first thing they do is contact the ombudsman, and the ombudsman's responsibility is to advocate for that individual when maybe they can't advocate for themselves. HICAP is our Medicare group. This is a group of highly trained people who consult on Medicare, help you understand what you need, what the best programs are for you out there, completely unbiased. So during open enrollment between October and December every year, they do a whole series of different meetings and presentations, helping people understand what the best type of coverage might be for them. I'm going to skip my program and talk about it at the end. We have a couple socialization wellness programs, the Friendly Visitor and the Reconnect. They're very similar, but there's one main difference. The Friendly Visitor program is a program of senior social workers who come to, who are paired with an individual who isn't able to leave their home for any number of reasons. Maybe they're bedridden, maybe they're ill. And what the Friendly Visitor does is they call on them one time a week to make sure that they have the food that they need, the services, the medical care that they need. If they need in-home care, they assist them in trying to find that. So they make sure that this individual has what they need and that they're taken care of when perhaps there isn't anyone else looking in on them. The Reconnect program is similar. The difference is these are individuals who have the ability to get outside their home, but they're not connected to the community any longer. So it might be because they're recently widowed or widowered. They may have recently moved to a new location to be by family and realize that family's always busy and they don't actually know anyone. So they're then paired with an individual who will go out and do things with them. Maybe go to the movies, go to a book club, go to the beach, go out and have lunch, any kind of thing that helps reconnect them to the community. Both of these programs are full year programs, 12-month programs. The Reconnect program, we rarely have a participant that's there longer than 6 or 7 months. And the reason is because they reconnect quite quickly and they come back to us as peer mentors and volunteers. So it's a really wonderful program. Outreach and education. I actually sort of fall into that program. I kind of fall into all of these programs because of what it is that we do at Senior Protection. The Smile Maker program is a Christmas program where the ombudsman will come to us with a list of residents who don't have family or might be forgotten at the holidays. And we put together a great big, sort of like Santa's workshop. And all of these gifts are donated by organizations, individuals, all throughout Orange County and out through Riverside County. And last year we had about 5,500 gifts that were donated. They come into Santa's workshop. We have a lot of volunteers from the community, from major corporations and various organizations that come in and wrap these gifts. These gifts then have the name of the individual and the gift that they had requested put into bags, and the ombudsman take them out to the facilities, put them under a tree so that when they have their holiday celebration, each of these people receives a gift and isn't forgotten during the holiday. It's a really wonderful program and probably highlights one of the nicest things about Orange County, which is just the pure generosity of so many people. The Concierge Care Navigators group is the only fee-for-service program that we have. This is a group of nurses and gerontologists who assist families in navigating the aging process. So for instance, my mom's 89, and I thought, having worked here for the last 8 years, I probably knew everything I needed to know about taking care of an older person and maybe getting all the services she needed. I was wrong. You don't know what you don't know until you realize you don't know it. And I reached out to Concierge Care Navigators, and they assisted me in finding in-home care and having the proper neurology tests done to understand what may or may not be happening. So I highly recommend them. They're very, very easy to work with, and they're very well established in the community. They have a lot of experience as well. And then my program, the Senior Protection Program. What we mainly do is education. We come out, we educate people about fraud, about elder abuse, how to protect yourself from it, how to protect other people, how to recognize it. And that's exactly what we're going to do today. So the population in Orange County, this is based on 2010 census. So in 2010, we had 400,000 individuals in Orange County, 65 and over. If you flash forward to 2050, we now have a double of that population. So we're looking at, instead of 43 million, we're now at almost 84 million. If you take out the segment of those of us who are 85 and over, we're looking at a tripling of that population. So if you think about that, what we're basically saying is the concentration of older people in Orange County is growing. It's doubling and tripling. So what does that mean? It means that there's a lot of opportunity for people who want to prey on older people, perpetrate crimes. It makes it very easy for them to find a target because there are now so many of us. So we're going to talk about financial abuse. What is financial abuse? It's the fastest growing, least reported crime, not just in California, but the United States and the world. California represents 11% of the nationally reported cases, which unfortunately for us makes us number one in the country. And then Orange County tends to be number one in the state of California. So not exactly the number one position we want to find ourselves in. So one of the best ways to prevent yourself or someone that you love from becoming a victim of a scam is to understand the anatomy. So it's kind of like a dog. You can put a dog in lots of costumes. He can be a pirate one day. He can be a soldier. He can be dressed up as a pumpkin. He can be dressed as all kinds of things. But at the end of the day, he's still just a dog. Scams are the same way. They come to us in lots of different ways. They can come on your phone. They can come in the mail. They can be an individual knocking at your door, someone stopping you in a parking lot, an email that you receive, an attachment to an email, a phone call. It can be any number of things, but they all have four main characteristics in common. And that's the most important thing to remember as we move through this. The very first thing, unsolicited contact from a stranger or a trusted source. So many of us have received phone calls that look like they're coming from the IRS, or they look like they're coming from Social Security, or they look like they might be coming from some other recognizable or trusted source that you feel like you want to answer that call. The most important thing to remember is most of these organizations are never going to call you unless you initiate the very first call. So if you didn't initiate the call, the chances are very high. A call coming in from Social Security or coming in from the IRS is an unsolicited contact from a stranger, meaning it's probably not a real call. But if you answer that call, what's the next thing that happens? Whoever's on the other end of that phone is going to offer you something that's valuable to you. That thing of value could be money.
Don't answer the call.
So if the IRS contacts you, or the fake IRS contacts you, and they tell you that they need to clarify your banking information because they're not able to automatically deposit your check, what's of value to you? Obviously the check. If you're retired and you're really depending on the money that comes in every month from Social Security or your pension or anything else, that's of a value to you. So the next thing they're going to do is they're going to ask for personal or financial information. Well, in order for me to automatically deposit this check into your account, we seem to have a problem. Could you please confirm your banking information? So now you've given them your banking information, your checking information, any of that. Or sometimes they'll ask for, let's say that if somebody's saying that you owe, the IRS is saying you owe them money. First, it's unsolicited contact from a stranger. What's of value to you? They're telling you that you owe taxes. So the last thing you want is a lien against your property. So you're going to listen. And the next thing they're going to do is ask you for a way to pay for this. So they might ask you for banking information. They might ask you for a credit card or some way that you can pay this. Once you have given them the information, personal and or financial, now what they're really going to try and do is get you off the phone. They've already got what they wanted. They can either steal your identity, create new accounts using your credit. You've already given them enough information. So it's important to recognize that if you get to step three and you realize they're asking you for something, especially personal and financial information, it takes two pieces of information to steal your identity. There's so much information about us out there that is public domain. There's not a lot that they need to figure out how to pretend to be us. And then they'll try to get off the phone as quickly as possible so that they can get right to the crime that they're planning to commit. So some of the most important and common scams we see, we talked a little bit about the IRS. Social Security is one that pretty much everybody has seen. We also see a lot of romance scam. And one of the ones in romance scam that is becoming more prevalent is something called confidential marriage. Confidential marriage is, it comes from a law that was specific to California beginning in 1878. And the whole purpose of it was to allow people who are living together in a community law or community marriage kind of situation to legalize their relationship. California is one of the only states that doesn't recognize common law marriage. Therefore, they created a law that allowed people who had been living together as man and wife to secure that as a legal marriage. Therefore, the husband or the wife could then have all of the rights of a legal spouse. What we're beginning to see is this law being used as a basically a legal way to access an older person's estates and assets. So for instance, we've seen cases where, let's say it's a person who's a housekeeper, and the housekeeper comes in, and one particular case, this housekeeper comes from another country. She's already married. She has a family. She begins working for a gentleman, and she pretty soon convinces the gentleman to get married, but she wants to have a secret marriage. So what happens is his family doesn't know anything about it. There's no record of it, because in order to access a record, you have to go through the court to get a court order. We're beginning to see an increase in this kind of crime. And we call it a legal crime only from the perspective they're going through a legal process of getting married, but there's all kinds of undue stress and pressure to get this older adult to agree to this. And the family doesn't know. The only way that this can be annulled is either to identify that it's happening while the older adult is still alive and go and be able to prove that this was void from the very beginning and annul it, after the fact, when the older adult has passed away, and this is usually when people realize it's happened because it's a secret, when the family realizes it's happening, they have to be able to go back and they have to have enough evidence to prove that this wasn't an actual marriage. This was a sham marriage and it was done solely for the purpose of accessing the older adult's funds or estate. This is a really serious crime, and it's really important for everyone to understand that confidential marriage is in fact legal in the state of California and Texas, only two states in the country. And we are beginning to see a significant rise in the utilization of that specifically to access older adults' finances. So some of the stories scammers tell: your social security number is frozen, we need your banking information. Okay, step one, social security calls. Yes, it's unsolicited, but you picked it up because it's important. They're asking you or offering you something of value, the value of your social security check. They're going to ask you for financial or personal information so you can access your money. And then they're going to get you off the phone as quickly as possible. Same thing with the IRS. IRS is not going to call you if you've ever tried to call them. I think I was on the phone with them for 2 or 3 hours to try to find out what happened to a particular check. They don't have the manpower to contact you. They're likely not going to unless you have contacted them first. Same thing with the police department. A lot of times, especially in the city of Irvine where I live, we received calls from the Irvine Police Department, and it was telling us that we had warrants out for our arrests for having expired or too many parking tickets, and they wanted us to pay for it online. Well, the first thing that happened, because I got the call and I actually did answer it, the Irvine Police Department. I work with them, but on top of that, sometimes they'll call you to let you know something's going on in your neighborhood. So then when they asked, they already knew who I was. So somewhere they had already gotten my cell phone number and they knew my name. Then they told me there was a warrant out for my arrest for expired parking tickets. So when I dug a little deeper to find out, well, where exactly were the parking tickets? Because I knew I didn't have any. Then they were trying to get me to pay for it on the line. So it was an unsolicited call. I picked it up because it looked important. What are they offering to me? They're telling me if I don't pay these parking tickets, somebody's going to come over and arrest me because I haven't paid these tickets. So if I pay for them right now on the phone, then they'll leave me alone and they'll clear these tickets. All four of those red flags: unsolicited call, offering me something of value, pressuring me or asking me for personal and financial information to take care of this problem, and then getting me off the phone as quickly as possible. So during COVID-19, we saw a significant rise in what we call cybercrime. Cybercrime is the crime that occurs on your smartphone, with texts, with phone calls, on the internet, with your emails, on your smart TV, anything where you're dealing with the internet. Elderly people are most at risk, and the reason is basically because most of us are not that tech savvy. Some people are in the younger category, like if in the state of California from age 60 and on, 60 is relatively young for an older adult. So those of us that are in that category have probably worked in companies. A lot of us have worked in the computer industry. When you start getting up to the 75 and older group of older adults, you're now looking at people who maybe don't understand cell phones very well, don't really know how to use the internet very well. And because they're really wanting to be part of it, they had a lot of time sitting at home when they weren't allowed to go anywhere during COVID to begin learning how to do it. And they made a lot of errors. And as a result, we had a huge increase in cybercrime, mostly at the expense of our older adults. So this is information that comes from the Federal Bureau of Investigation, their Internet Crime Compliance Center, or what we call IC3. If you think that you have ever been or you are currently being targeted for a cybercrime, the first thing you want to do is contact the FBI, and you would go to ic3.gov to report this. There's also a local duty agent number here in Orange County that if this ever does happen, contact us and we'll put you directly in touch with them. This is information that came to us 2020. This is the most recent information from the FBI, and this shows the number of victims. Over 40, the largest number of victims is the older adults. And if you look at the dollar amount, it is significantly higher than the next age category. If you look at the age, if you look at the victims by age group, you'll also see in the next one down that over 60 is the age category with the highest incidence of crime and the largest dollar amount. Now, if you look at, this is the 2019 information. So from 2018 to 2020, we've seen a significant increase in the number of victims in California and the amount of dollars lost per victim. This is the new 2020 information. And what we're able to see is even before COVID, this was a problem. It's just gotten significantly worse. California and Florida are the two leading states in terms of numbers of instances, and California is number one in overall dollars lost. Now, keep in mind, this is based on reported cases. One in 24 cases are reported. So that would obviously tell us that the dollar amount we're talking about is really significantly higher. This is only what they really know about. And also keep in mind that one in 10 older adults are going to be targeted or going to be a victim of some kind of crime, typically cybercrime. I read an article, I read a lot of FBI stuff, and I read an article the other day that said cybercrime is the third largest economy behind America and China. That's kind of a jarring statistic, because that means that the amount of money lost, not just through Americans, but all throughout the world, is larger than the majority of countries out there in terms of their GDPs other than us and China. That's pretty scary stuff. So why are older adults most at risk for different types of fraud and exploitation? One of the biggest reasons is because older adults were raised in a different era. They were raised to be polite. They were raised to answer the phone, to speak to people, to open the door and speak to people, to be polite. And as a result, they tend to be a little bit more vulnerable because people know that older adults are going to be polite. Whereas we taught our children stranger danger, now our children are teaching us stranger danger. It's kind of an interesting full circle that we've made with who is now vulnerable. What makes us vulnerable? There's a lot of general susceptibilities, memory loss and dementia. The statistic out there right now is about 50% of us are going to experience some amount of memory loss or dementia. That puts us at risk because we may not be clearly able to understand what someone's telling us, or we may be easily led to believe what they're telling us is true. We may have health and medical problems where we're dependent on someone else, and that might be a person who is violating our fiduciary responsibilities. Maybe they're the person who is in fact financially abusing us. And we don't want to say anything because who's going to take care of us? Maybe depression, anxiety, and trauma. We saw a lot of this during COVID. People were home. People went through grief and loss and loneliness because they weren't allowed to leave. They may have lost a spouse. People who were even living in licensed facilities weren't even allowed to leave their rooms. They were having to receive their meals in their rooms. The whole reason that people go into facilities like this is to help them with a lot of the social kinds of interactions that they need and want. So COVID really allowed a lot of the perpetrators of these types of crimes to really take off, because too many of us were answering our phones. Too many of us were learning to use our computers and making errors. Too many of us were opening things we shouldn't have opened, answering texts, opening attachments in an email, responding to an email, and opening ourselves up to all kinds of fraud. We might be financially independent or financially dependent on somebody else. We're afraid to say anything because what if you're living with your son and your son is the person who's actually financially abusing you? Who are you going to report that to? What are you going to do? Because if you say something, what if that means now you don't have anywhere to live? Nobody's going to take care of you. So there's a lot of reasons why we don't report it, but there's a lot of things that make us very susceptible. And also impaired activities of daily living. If we're dependent on someone else to assist us in the morning, to make meals for us, to help us get from our bed to the table, then if that's the person who is financially abusing us, we are highly unlikely to report it because we're afraid. We're afraid, who's going to do these things for me if I report this person? So a lot of times financial fraud is tolerated for unfortunate reasons. We receive probably 75 calls in a given month from people who believe that they're a victim of fraud, think their target is a victim of fraud, or think they know someone who is being targeted. And I would say 90% of the time, capacity is an issue. And capacity is our ability to make decisions for ourselves. It's our cognitive ability to be able to recall things, recognize things, understand things. Determined by a court of law in California. So our state says capacity is presumed until a court of law says otherwise, which means it doesn't matter how many professional doctors and neurologists do a test on Karen Rossi and say, Karen doesn't have capacity. It has to be a court in a, it has to be a judge in a courtroom who says, Karen does not have capacity in order for me to lose my rights to make decisions. So capacity is really complicated because I might not be able to make good decisions financially, but maybe I know exactly what I like to eat, where I want to live, who I want to be around, whether or not I want to go somewhere, where I want to live, but maybe I just can't make decisions very well about my finances. So unfortunately, a lot of times in the past, what we've seen is kind of like autism. You have a spectrum. Just because I can't make financial decisions doesn't mean I can't make decisions about other things in my life. And what this does in the state of California is it gives me the right to make decisions until a court of law says otherwise about anything. I can decide who handles my finances. I can give my money away. I can get myself involved in some kind of a scam, a romance scam, or some kind of an investment scam or a Ponzi scheme or something like that. And not realize that that's what I'm involved in, but that's only a small part of my ability to make decisions. And my autonomy shouldn't be taken away because I can't make good decisions specifically on that when I'm perfectly capable of making decisions in other ways. The downside to the California law is that it allows us to make decisions on our behalf, whether they're good or bad. And it's the making of not particularly good decisions that always comes into play in California. So what was the purpose of the law in the first place? It was to ensure the protection of an individual's autonomy and their right to self-determination. None of us want our rights taken away. Everybody's probably pretty familiar with the Britney Spears case. Here's a young woman who had all of her rights taken away in a conservatorship. Conservatorships can only be granted by the court. They can be ordered because a person is dangerous to themselves. They can be done to a person in a situation where they think the person can't take care of themselves any longer. Only a court can conserve a person. The laws in California changed in January, making it very, very difficult to conserve a person. And the reason is because Britney Spears spent 10 years trying to get unconserved. The problem is that once a person is conserved, it is very, very difficult to walk that back. The court doesn't have a lot of interest in lifting a conservatorship from a person. It costs a lot of money and it takes a long time. So it's important to understand that that should be the very last option any of us want. We should not want to conserve a person, nor should we want to be conserved unless we really are unable to take care of ourselves and the court determines that that's necessary. So in California, your ability to make decisions for yourself is presumed until a court of law says otherwise, which means I can make lots of interest. I can make lots of decisions that are not in my best interest. I can make things that don't make sense, and I can make decisions that are actually harmful to myself. So some of the obvious red flags, those of us all know, either family members, ourselves, other people that we are around. And these are important things to think about because every one of us is a target. It doesn't matter how well-educated you are. It doesn't matter how careful you are with your money. Everybody makes a mistake. Everybody is capable of falling for these scams because they're actually very, very good. These people are incredibly good at these crimes. So some of the more obvious things, if you notice that one of your friends or someone you care for has a new friend or a new love interest, ask questions. Where did you meet this person? Try to find out if this is one of those online romance scams or if it's in fact just a really nice gentleman or nice woman that they met at the country club, or maybe they met when they went to their book club reading. If you notice an increase in computer and phone use, not necessarily just an increase in that, but oftentimes a secret increase in doing this. See if you can get that individual to share with you you know, why are you using your computer more? You were getting more involved in doing different types of things. And the reason that the computer and phone use is important is because when you're talking about cybercrime, seniors are the number one target. And they're a target by a long way. And they're also the ones that lose the greatest amount of money. So if you see increased computer and phone use, or you notice yourself that you're doing it, make sure you know how to protect yourself. If you're visiting somebody and you notice the jewelry that the person has always worn is no longer there, maybe Bob used to wear a really great ring and all of a sudden his ring is missing. Or maybe Susie had a beautiful diamond brooch and all of a sudden she's not wearing it anymore. Missing jewelry is often an indication of some kind of financial scam or some kind of situation where they might be selling their jewelry or giving it away. Secretive behavior, hiding and hoarding mail, taking calls in private, whispering, all of a sudden unusual purchases, boxes and boxes of things from Amazon showing up on the porch. Here are some of the not so obvious things. Over time, a change of appearance and hygiene habits. If all of a sudden, over time, you notice somebody starts wearing their nicest dress, or Bob's wearing his favorite bolo, and all of a sudden they're in a really great mood, they're very giddy, they're very happy, ask questions. Why are you so happy? Holy cow, you look great today. Sometimes it's a romantic interest. Sometimes it's a real romantic interest. Sometimes it's a scam. Same thing with the decline. If you see over time a decline in an individual, all of a sudden they're not taking care of themselves. Maybe they're not, their hair doesn't seem to be combed, or Bob's not shaving, or their clothing doesn't seem to be clean. A change in mood or behavior. They might be angry or depressed. These kinds of things can often be directly linked to financial issues and directly linked to financial fraud. And sometimes, in fact, in most cases of financial fraud, you also have emotional abuse and physical abuse. So it's important to look at what are the not so obvious signs. Unmet basic needs, that could change, that could signal a change in finances. So basically, if a person doesn't have enough food in their home, or the person has not been taking a shower, or maybe they haven't been paying their utility bills, and all of a sudden there's a recognition that there's something not quite right. And self-neglect is one of the big things that we see also. So the not so obvious red flags. So if we think we're a target, or we think we know someone who's a target, what do we do? Well, the first thing is prevention. Educate yourself, watch for the four red flags. Watch for the unsolicited call from some important or seemingly important entity. Watch for the offering of something of value. It doesn't have to be money. It could be somebody knocking on your door wanting you to donate to the homeless veterans. We saw during COVID that they were walking around trying to collect money for the homeless veterans to have COVID vaccines. I don't know anybody that paid for a COVID vaccine. So what did they do? They were unsolicited. They knocked on your door. It was during COVID. People were lonely. They were answering their door. And they asked for something of value. It pulls on your heartstrings. Everybody loves the vets. Of course, you want to help them. So then they ask you for a way to pay for that. If you used cash, you're lucky. But what if you gave them a check? It has all of your checking information and banking information. What if you gave them a credit card? Now they have access to your actual credit card information. So we began to see a lot of this during COVID. And what's important is to recognize those four flags, because I can't tell you how many times my phone rings and I look at the number and I don't know who it is. And I have a habit of letting it roll to voicemail. But what's really important is when I get the voicemail, if it says this is the IRS and I'm calling because you owe back taxes, the very first thing you do, don't call the number that's in your voicemail. Go back and look at what is the actual phone number. What is the proper phone number for Medicare? What is the proper phone number for Social Security or the IRS or any other organization that leaves a message for you and wants you to call them back? They're obviously going to leave you either the phone number that leads you right back into that scam, or a link to some kind of an email or a site that leads you right back into that scam. So really important, if you think you've fallen for it or you're hearing a message, go to the source. Go back to what you know is real. Talk about it. If any of you have ever been a victim of a scam, talk about it. Talk about it amongst each other, because I guarantee you are not the only one. It happens to family, it happens to friends, it happens in clubs. It's really important to talk about, because it's better to be very informed and know that these kinds of things are going on than to not realize that you're falling right into the hands of a perpetrator and you're about to lose a bunch of money. How do you report it? Well, if you're living independently in your own home, call Adult Protective Services in Orange County. There is an 800 hotline number, and you can file a report. That is the gateway for local law enforcement. The second thing is, go to your local police department, and if it's the sheriff's department, go directly to them and file a report. They're not going to really want to take your report, so you're going to have to force the issue, because they think it's a civil suit, or they think it's a civil case. It is, but it's also a criminal case. And the DA is not going to be able to press charges if there isn't some kind of a police report indicating that a crime has, in fact, we suspect a crime has taken place. So the first thing, call Adult Protective Services. Honestly, if you don't know what to do, call our office, call the Council on Aging, because we will connect you to all the important people that you need to talk to if you think that you're a victim. If you're in a facility, or you know someone who is in a California licensed facility, the first group that they call are the ombudsmen. The ombudsmen are the direct conduit to all the types of reporting that need to happen to allow this person to be advocated for and protected. How do you recover? You need to enlist an advocate. You need to sometimes seek legal advice and counsel. A lot of the calls that come into us, we have to turn over to attorneys or sometimes law enforcement, because sometimes the calls that come in are in fact crimes. I work directly with the FBI. I work directly with local law enforcement. We have a lot of cases that we turn over to them for investigation. We also work directly with pro bono law firms and for fee attorney firms, because sometimes the only way to fight these is to actually have an attorney. A lot of times it has to do with false legal documentation and things like that. And it's important to understand what the resources are that are available. The Council on Aging has a lot of resources specifically to help educate about this. If you have specific questions, or if you're curious about anything, this is toward the end. So I appreciate all your time, and please let me know if you have any questions.
Karen, I think this was pretty comprehensive and probably one of the best presentations I've seen on this topic so far.
Thank you.
I would just add that I don't think there's a person on this call that probably hasn't been impacted in some way by a scam. I'll echo what you said earlier. I am really impressed, and this is a sad statement, I am really impressed with how good these people are.
You're absolutely right. There, 2 years ago, we did a WEAD presentation in June for Elder Abuse Awareness Day. And we had a speaker who came from the cybercrime group at the DA's office. And he talked about how good these people are. And he was telling us he had gotten a call, and it was somebody that was calling from another country. And he asked them, how exactly does this work? He said, you know, you called the DA's office, you know that we're local law enforcement here in America. So what is it that you do? It turns out that you have a lot of people in what we used to call third world countries, which are more like second world countries now. But there's a lot of people that are very bright. They go to university, they get a great degree, say programming and engineering. They can't find a job there. So what do? They set up these things called sales offices. And these sales offices have banks of phones. And all they do is they find phone numbers. They buy phone numbers. They hack into things. They steal phone numbers and they start calling. And it's like dialing for dollars. And the minute that the DA or any cybersecurity organization begins to understand and realize what's going on, it's almost like these criminals are so good, they pivot. They're always two steps ahead. And even when the DA tells you that that's the case and they're working on cybercrime and Bitcoin and all these things for money muling that we see a lot of, it's very frustrating. But probably the most important thing to recognize is if you get caught up in a scam like this, It's not a statement about how smart or not smart you are. It's a statement about how darn good they are, because they're really, really good.
For you, Karen. Elizabeth?
Did I understand correctly that you said that in California, these secret marriages are not accepted?
No, you didn't. Maybe I misspoke. In the state, there's only two states in America that that don't recognize common law marriage. One of them is California. And there are only two states that have this secret marriage law. The secret marriage law means that if you've been living together in a common law as husband and wife, in the state of California, if one of you passes away, you are not legally married. So what the secret marriage does is it allows you to quietly get married. Now you are a legal spouse. So if something happens to you or your spouse, you have the legal rights of a married individual. The frightening thing about this is it's secret. Nobody sees it. It isn't like when I got married and my marriage record is public record. Anybody can go online and anybody can find it. I didn't do a secret marriage. If I did a secret marriage, nobody in my family would be able to see it. I'm the only one with access to it. The only way you could get access to it is through a court order. So what I was saying was that California is one of the only two states that still has this secret marriage law, because they don't recognize common law. And I'm beginning to see organizations sort of promote this as a way to avoid or prevent identity theft. Total lie. It has nothing to do with identity theft. Total lie. It's just, it's interesting because, you know, I kind of called them and asked them about it, and they got a little upset with me when I told them that they were kind of perpetrating a lie, but I guess nobody likes to be called a liar. But so I hope that clarifies it for you. It's a law that goes back to the 1870s. And honestly, there's a lot of action with different types of groups. I'm part of one of them where we're trying to get litigation and legislation changed so that we can either change the law or get it completely dropped from the books, because there is no purpose for this law. There really isn't a purpose for it. It was originally done in the 1800s to protect a woman's virtue. If she had been living with this man, supposedly in sin, as they used to say, this gave her the legal opportunity to say, no, we're actually married. And nobody would know if it were true or not.
Karen, before we move to Sherry and then Colette, I sent you an email on that confidential marriage topic, okay?
Oh, perfect.
Sherry?
Not on that topic, but I've gotten a couple emails lately from friends that were obviously hacked, because they are asking for gift cards. I'll repay you the minute I'm back in town. What should I do with that besides just delete the email? I mean, I notify my friend to let them know they've been hacked. Is there anything? And you know, when I click on the email, it's their email. So it looks like it's coming from them, but
yeah, the number one cybercrime is what they call phishing. And pretty much from what I'm reading, I mean, I can look at the 2020 crime types by victim in an FBI report. And here are your top crimes: phishing, vishing, smishing, and farming. I guess anything that rhymes with phishing. But what it basically is emailing people and trying to pretend you're someone else, emailing under the guise of being your friend. It's sometimes difficult to tell, but if you know your friend well enough, you'll be able to tell that the question they're asking, or just the way that they're stating something, maybe there's a misspelling, maybe there's a grammatical error, and you know that person wouldn't make that error. The best that you can do is delete it and put it in junk. It's almost impossible to prevent these kinds of things from coming through. It's more important that you recognize that they're there. Those can happen on your cell phone too. You can get phone calls coming in looking like they're coming from your friend when somebody has basically absconded with their phone number, and they have created a way to make their call coming into you looking like it's coming from your friend. That's why it's really important to understand and recognize, if you didn't initiate a call from an organization, if there's something, look at the emails on some of these things. Look at what the email address is. A lot of times it'll be an alphanumeric, like string with maybe some characters in there. Who makes up an email like that? If you want to make up an email, I'm going to remember, like Happy Dog or, you know, Karen's Cool. You don't want an email that looks like blah, 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 because nobody knows what that is. And they're never going to remember it. And that's a key right there, is when you look at those kinds of emails and that's what it looks like, delete it, because the chances are very high that it is a scam.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Did you have a question?
Me?
Yes, your hand's raised.
Yeah. Okay, so here's my question. On that secret marriages, do they not do income taxes together then? I mean, is there something there that I don't know the right wording, but wouldn't that be a tag on something, or they don't have to file together, things of that nature? Or
You can be married filing separately. I don't know the answer to your question. It's a good question because I see where you're going with it. If you found out that your parent was filing taxes with another individual and that individual wasn't someone you thought was their wife or their husband, that would be a red flag. And that would be definitely something to look at and question. In the cases where I know that this has occurred, the individual is married to the perpetrator. The perpetrator literally takes over all the finances. They become like the power of attorney for finance. They go in and they change the trust, and they make themselves be the key beneficiary in the trust. And then if there are children, sometimes there might be stepchildren now, and that dilutes the trust even further for distribution. So, and these things are all done legally because this person is now a legal spouse. So they can go and they can go to the attorney and they can have trusts changed. So we begin to see this kind of thing happening. And the individual who's usually perpetrating it is the person who heads up all the finances and controls everything. So the chances of the family knowing that this person is involved, they could think that this is just the housekeeper. They might not even realize the housekeeper is actually your dad's wife now. They might not even live together. Some of the things that we find out, these people don't even live together. This is some legal document that allows me to be married to an older man that owns 5 properties. And as soon as he passes away, I'm rich. And I can wipe his whole family off trust legally because I'm his wife. It's frightening stuff.
Yeah, if there is a family to wipe out. Yeah.
Well, you're right. There is actually a case. I've seen this woman show up 3 different times in the last 3 or 4 years. She's a caregiver out of LA. She usually works in the Garden Grove area. And she has a caregiving company, but she's not licensed, which if you're ever going to hire a caregiver, only hire a licensed caregiver. You need to have the support of knowing that there is some legal and some kind of recourse if you hire a person and they either they don't turn out right, or you have financial issues or whatever. But in the case of this woman, she presents herself as a caregiver. She gets hired or referred by somebody who supposedly used her before. It's almost always men who have cognitive issues. So they have some level of dementia. They might have Alzheimer's, but they stay in their homes and they want a 24/7 caregiver. So she brings herself in as the caregiver. She convinces the individual, because he doesn't have full cognitive capability, to turn all of his finances over to her. So she becomes a power of attorney for finance. She then controls all of his banking. He doesn't have any family. Nobody knows that this is happening, except that there's a woman who's a renter and she's known him for a long time. And in one of his 5 properties, this woman lives. When he finally passes away, she contacts us and she says, hey, something's really wrong here. All of a sudden I'm evicted. They're selling these properties and the person selling them is his caregiver. Well, as it turns out, I reported this to the DA and I reported it to a number of different law enforcement people that we work a lot with. They know who she is. The problem is they can't catch her in the act of doing it while the individual is still alive. And to have, for the DA to prosecute for a crime, there has to be a victim. He doesn't have any family. He's gone. There isn't a victim. Clearly, in our minds, there's a crime, but there's nothing you can do about it. She's done it 3 times. And the last time she did it, she walked away with about $5 or $6 million. It's horrible. It makes me sick to think that this is what happens and that there's people out there like that. But you have to be so, so careful about who you allow around you, around your loved one, your family members, who's in the home, what access do they have? If you are, the most important thing really is planning ahead. Every one of us is going to have some level of cognitive decline. Please make sure you have in place all the proper legal documentation before you can't make decisions anymore. Make sure you know who your power of attorney for finance is going to be. Make sure they know that's their job. Make sure you have an advanced healthcare directive that tells everybody what you want for healthcare and your end of life request when you can't communicate any longer. Don't let someone make that decision for you. You have the ability to do it. Do it now while you still can. Make sure you don't just have a will. If all you have is a will, when you pass away, everything goes into probate. Probate takes 30 to 40% of it. And whatever's left afterward is what gets distributed to your family. And they decide. If you haven't written something down, the court decides how it gets distributed. It's really important to have a living trust. The living trust prevents you from going into probate, and it allows you to write the instructions for exactly what you want to have happen with all of your property, all of your estates, who's in, who's out, here's my stuff, here's my people, this is who gets all of my things. And it also allows you to define the power of attorney for finance is triggered when certain things happen. I can define when someone takes over my finances. I can define who I want to be the person to take over making decisions for me. But I can only do that when I still have the capability to be able to sign legal documents. Because once I lose that capability, we can't sign legal documents anymore, which means you can't get a trust. You can't create a trust if you don't have cognitive capability. And it doesn't necessarily mean at that point, this is a frustration too. It doesn't mean that the court has said Karen doesn't have capability. It means that a doctor might say, you know what, she doesn't know what's going on. She doesn't understand what she's signing. It's not legal for an attorney to have you sign a legal document when they know that you don't know what's going on. So the best thing for all of us to do is to make sure our legal docs are in place. And if they aren't, contact us if you need an attorney. We refer out to all kinds of attorneys, but please make sure that you know who your people are and you know when you can't make decisions anymore that you've chosen someone to do that for you and that individual knows who they are.
We have two more questions, Karen, then I think we're going to have to wrap up here. Tony?
You know, I don't think it's a problem, but one of the things that I think keeps people doing a living trust is the cost. Because I found that the cost for a living trust, you know, gets rather expensive after a while. So, you know. Is there any agencies that do this?
Most trusts, there are non-profits and there are pro bonos who do some of those documents. But in all honesty, the best way to have a trust done is to have an elder law attorney or someone who specializes in trusts do it for you, especially if you have a lot of assets or multiple properties or multiple investments. Because the average person doesn't really know what to put in a trust and not to put in a trust. You can download them from the internet, but I don't recommend that. Yes, they can be expensive, but if you put it in perspective, would you rather pay $3,500 to protect your $1 million house? Or would you rather take the risk that something might happen and you don't have it and then it goes into probate and 30 or 40% of it's gone and your family doesn't even get your house. So I hear what you're saying because I'm in the exact same spot right now. We're looking at doing all of our trust and legal documents. It isn't cheap, but you have to look at it as an investment to protect your own assets and to protect any inheritance that you might want to make forward to your family and distribute to your family after your passing. I hear you. Hey. Trust me on that one.
Elaine, do you have a question, please?
Yes, I have a question. It really bothers me, these confidential marriages. And because you're saying if the person passes away, then there's no victim. But I'm trying to think outside the box and that the victim would be if there was not this confidential spouse, who would inherit the assets? Maybe the charities? Or if no one is named, it would go to the state. So has it ever been looked at that either charities or the state are the victim? Because they would be the one getting the assets if there were not this confidential spouse.
Yeah, that's a great line of thinking. And I did ask the DA that question, because in the case of this woman, the gentleman would have left everything to a charity. But here's what happened. She went in and she had the trust changed. Mm-hmm. So the trust is the legal document. The trust is the direction. And that's what gets administered at the passing of the person whose trust it is. So she's smart about how she does it. Now, if there is family, that can be considered a victim. A lot of times with confidential marriages, what in the cases that we're seeing now, we're actually seeing that there is family. The family doesn't find out that the confidential marriage existed until the parent passes away. And all of a sudden, they think they're still the agent of the trust. They think they're the ones responsible for administering that trust at the passing of the last parent. And then they find out, they get a letter from an attorney finding out that they're not the person. They didn't even know. And so now, in order for the family to be able to annul that marriage, they have to be able to have material proof that that was a sham marriage in the first place. And so some of the cases that I'm familiar with, one of them is a woman who's from another country. She has a family in another country. She's married. And she did this because she wanted money to give to her family in another country. And the family is now trying to prove they didn't live together. They weren't really a marriage. It was a sham from the beginning. So it can be annulled after the fact if there's enough proof. But it's just unfortunately, it's what they call the legal crime.
And for the one that had a spouse in another country, are they then charged with bigamy?
I don't know the answer to that question. It's a relatively new crime. Or a new case. I don't know what the status of it is. I haven't talked to that particular attorney. She has about 3 cases like this. And I don't know how they go about prosecuting them or what they charge them with.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Kim, what's the attorney's name?
Edie Mermelstein.
Yeah, I've spoken to her. So I'm going to put a plug. I'm going to put a plug in. So just a reminder, everybody. CSL has been made aware of this issue through Evelyn Velez, and we're studying this issue. I've invited Karen to our next Orange County caucus meeting. I'll extend an invitation to Pauline and anyone else that wants to attend as well, if you want to stay connected to this, because this is ridiculous. So anyway, we believe we will be able to put a ledge proposal together here by the end of June, and we'll be working on this. So we'll continue to report on this.
That's great. Yeah, I love Edie. I refer people to her all the time.
Yeah, she's going to attend our next meeting as well.
She just did a presentation for our FAST group in Orange County. I think it was in January. Specific to confidential marriage. And that was my first intro into it. And when I started doing research into it, because we're redoing our webpage, our landing page for my department, and we're putting all kinds of links in there for great resources, the FTC, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the FBI, IC3, Cybercrime Group, all kinds of resources that people can just click on and go and see what are the most common crimes. What do I do if? Who do I report when it's this kind of a crime? She's been incredibly helpful, and she is the person I was talking about with the cases.
Yeah,
she's just super. I love her.
Desiree, is George Dixon going to be joining us, or is this the entire presentation we have on? Go ahead, Desiree.
This is Pauline. Oh, go ahead.
It looks like George is actually scheduled for March, not.
Great. Okay. Super. Karen, again,
yes.
I think I speak for the entire group. Thank you very much for a outstanding presentation.
Oh, thank you.
Much appreciated. And sadly, something that I think every one of us risk the potential of experiencing to some degree.
Yeah.
One of our California senior legislators has firsthand experience at a scam and was duped into believing Social Security was contacting her. Mm-hmm. So it's a crime that touches anybody in the senior ranks.
And honestly, it touches anybody who has a cell phone and up. So even little kids can get scammed. It's just sad. Everybody's a target. It doesn't matter how smart you are, how well educated you are or not. It doesn't matter if you feel dumb when it happens to you. It is so important to report it. We cannot expect law enforcement to do something if we don't tell them what's happening. So even if there's no chance of getting your money back, which a lot of times there's not, especially when it's money muling and Bitcoining, all that kind of stuff, the money's out of the country, it's gone. But you've got to report it because you don't want it, one, to happen to you again or to happen to anybody you care for. We have to report these things.
Yeah, I'm just, it saddens me deeply. How can these people put their head on the pillow at nighttime and rest knowing that they've taken these, you know, innocent, vulnerable seniors to the cleaners? It's remarkable to me that someone could do that.
Yeah, I have a comment that I say a lot. It kind of hit me about a year ago and I started looking at all these horrible things that people do. And I said to one of my coworkers, I said, have you ever wondered how big is hell? It's got to be huge. It's got to be so big. And I thought, man, I hate hot weather and I sure hope I'm not going there, but it has got to be unbelievably big.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I think it's insane, but I'm a firm believer in what goes around comes around.
Oh, karma's a big thing. I'm with you
absolutely.
On that.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Well, again, Karen, thank you very much. Oh, sorry, go ahead, Lynn.
One last question. Are there some buzzwords or something we can use with seniors to really make them stop? Because I have experience. I have someone who we did a presentation on this to the women's club. A month later, she gets this one of the calls that her Amazon order of computers isn't going to be delivered. She doesn't have an Amazon account. She didn't order any computers, but she did exactly what they said. And she went to the bank, took out thousands of dollars, went to the store, bought gift cards, kept the guy on her phone in her purse because he told her to do that. At the bank, they asked her if she needed help because they thought something was fishy. When she was buying the gift cards at Target, they thought something was fishy. Asked her if but she went through the whole thing, gave them the gift card numbers, and then called me. What are the buzzwords we use? Like stop in your tracks. Everyone along the way was trying to ask her if she needed help. You know, they thought something was wrong, and she just went through and
think before you act.
I've gotten a lot of calls from financial institutions specific to somebody like your friend who's gone in and withdrawn cash to go buy gift cards. Gift cards is one of the number one ways of laundering money. Mm-hmm. One thing I would say is the person who contacted her, they're threatening her and she's frightened. They can tell her someone's waiting outside. Someone's following you. Don't hang up. Don't tell the teller you're on the phone with me. We get a lot of calls from the bank because they can hear the person on the other side, because older people turn their phones up really loud. They don't hear particularly well on a cell phone, or they don't know how to control the volume. Mm-hmm. And the tellers can hear the other person. What would be the buzzwords? I don't know about buzzwords. I think just if you did not expect this call, if you did not initiate this call, probably one of the top types of cybercrime we're seeing right now are the tech cybercrimes, where they pretend that you purchase something from Amazon. That's a very common one. Anytime they're asking you to pay for something with gift cards, big clue right there.
Right.
Nobody does that. Nobody does that. That's one of the top ways they try to launder money. The other thing that she needs to be really careful of is if she gets involved in something like this, she's money muling, which basically means she's laundering money. And while she knows it or not, she's an accessory to a crime. And one of the things that we run into, and I've seen several of these Bitcoin cases come through, where they'll ask these individuals, they'll frighten the heck out of them. They'll tell them, you need to go to a bank and you need to open an account in this name. And then I'm going to send you a check and you're going to deposit it in there. Then you're going to immediately send it through Bitcoin to this other organization. It's almost always out of the country. We're seeing a lot of this. With Bitcoin, we got to get it to the DA right away, because Bitcoin, it's only like a couple of weeks that they can actually track stuff and then it's gone. But I don't know that there's buzzwords. I think more fear, honestly. Fear.
Yeah. Intimidation.
Yes, that this kind of thing is out there. I can't tell you, my mom's 89, almost 90, how many times I've said, Mom, don't answer the phone. And she picks it up, because it doesn't occur to her that anybody would do something like that. Yeah. They don't come from that era. It doesn't. It doesn't occur to them that there are horrible, awful people out there. And all they care about is what they can get from you. So buzzword wise, I don't know. Putting in the fear of God, letting them know, you know, you have to be really careful. If you didn't initiate the call, if you didn't order anything, don't respond. Mm-hmm. These are very, very common. Like the USPS text that you get that says that they can't deliver a package. You didn't order a package. It's a scam. But sometimes it's just very difficult for people to see. And in her case, I suspect they threatened her and she was frightened. And she did whatever they said, because maybe they said someone's watching you, or we're going to send someone to your house to arrest you. Chances are pretty good they're not even in the country when they're calling her. Mm-hmm. And the money is immediately out of the country.
Yeah. Elaine, does she have family that maybe you can have a conversation with?
Yeah, no, she doesn't have family. The irony is, we just had the presentation the month before at the Women's Club meeting. And then she called me, because I happened to be mayor at the time. I've got a deputy over there right away to take a report. But they said, you know, the money was gone.
Yeah.
So it's unfortunate. And she goes, I knew it was wrong, but I went ahead and did.
Plus, the other thing, it's so hard to help someone who doesn't help themselves. Mm-hmm. I mean, some of us do that. And when you're making the decision, it's like, God, I know it's a bad decision, but I'm going to go ahead and do it. No, trust your gut. Your gut's almost always right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's a sad story. I'm sorry to hear that happen to her.
Yeah.
Pauline, Elaine, maybe this is something for this group to come back to at a later time about, is there something we could devise, or with the assistance of the county, or something that would be like Elaine is trying to come up with, I believe, something that you can put on your refrigerator door, or something that is, or by the phone, that is a reminder that, whatever the buzzword is, whatever the phrase is, when in doubt, don't, or if it sounds too good to be true, it is. Or
trust your gut.
Whatever.
Trust your gut. Yeah.
Think twice. You know, this is scary, but think twice before picking up that phone. I mean, mm-hmm. that's going to an extreme, but maybe there's something we could think about that would allow us to help.
Good suggestions, John. Yeah, really good suggestions. Let me think about it a little bit and work with county staff to see if that's something that we could possibly
maybe
do.
A checklist, like only answer the phone if you know the name on the caller ID.
Right.
And even I don't answer if I don't know the name, because I'm here, if they really want me, they'll leave a message.
Yeah, exactly. Well, then that's a generational issue, I think, Elaine, because we are in a mindset that's somebody soliciting. Okay. If their name doesn't show up, I don't pick up the phone. And most of us are cell phone people, whereas another generation beyond us is all landline. And it's part of the day. Wow, somebody's reaching out to me. All right. I want to talk to somebody, which is
especially if you're lonely, especially if you're in a house by yourself and you have no one to talk to.
You're really vulnerable.
You're vulnerable. You're vulnerable.
But there's also corporations like Kaiser. When they call me, there's never, only for the main appointment line does it say Kaiser main appointment line. You can never call back to the medical offices. They come in from all different numbers and none of them are identified. So if I have any kind of health issue, I'm going to want to be answering the phone. I don't know if there's a way to insist that places like that have some identification on their phone, but you know, that's a huge corporation.
Sherry, that's a really, really good point. I ran into something very similar to that a couple of weeks ago with a credit union. I had gotten an 800 number call and I thought, that's odd. And so I let it roll. And when I listened to the voicemail, they said it was the credit union and they were calling about fraud on my card. And my immediate thought was, that's really weird. Why did that call come in and it didn't say anything? So what I did was I blocked my number on my phone. Do you know how to do that? Star 6. Okay. So I blocked the number on my phone and I called them back and it was my credit union. And I talked to their fraud department and I said, you guys need to put your name on this because when it comes through as an 800 number, I work in scams. Everything in the world is a scam to me. I can make the best thing turn into a scam in my head. And you're absolutely right. But the one thing, I saw a presentation about a year ago from one of our congresspeople in Buena Park. And one of the things that they said was, go to the source. So when you receive a call and you don't recognize the number, let's say it's Medicare, let's say it's your doctor's office, go to the source. You know the right number. Don't call the number that's in the voicemail if you don't know who's calling you.
Right.
Go to the source. And then if they leave a message and they tell you it's about something or there's an individual name, call the number you know back and ask for that person. The other thing is block the calls you don't want coming through. Do you know how to block calls on your phone? Really important to block them. You know what? It's not going to stop them all. They're still going to come through, but block them because it just makes it a little more difficult for them to get through the next time.
Yeah, I wanted to say, Karen, I got the information that you sent over to us, and I think that is invaluable in terms of getting information out, like in a little leaflet or a pamphlet form. And maybe we can look into maybe like producing some of those pamphlets, or if you have any extra, send them our way and we'd be happy to get them out.
I have a ton of that stuff. In fact, I have a bunch of one that I think is particularly good that I happen to find. It's the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Let me see if I can make it look good here. I can't get it.
Yeah, you need to pull back.
Yeah, it's not.
No, it's not. Yeah, no. You got a glare.
But it's called Money Smart for Older Adults. If you go onto their consumer, onto the CFPB.gov, onto the Consumer Protection Bureau's site, they have all kinds of documents. They're free and you can order them down. All kinds of things. This particular one is called Money Smart for Older Adults Resource Guide. It's dated June 2021. The other place that has excellent information, the FTC. And I can send you a lot of these links too. The FTC. The other place is the FBI.com, .gov, IC3.gov. They have a ton of documentation.
Okay, that's so good to know.
Rather than recreate the wheel, just, you know, I pull these things down all the time. And we do recreate the wheel because of our education process. But we also have all of these links and there's tremendous information. It's pretty updated. I mean, 2021 is pretty good for the federal government. 2020, I'm just waiting for the FBI to get the 2021 one out there. But I mean, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
That's
pretty good.
I'd
like to have the information available for SCAC in both formats, because as you say, we've got some people on our council that are on the younger end of old, and you have some people that are on the older end of old that are probably a little different. How they access information would be different, you know, across platforms. Some like, you know, printing out the brochure, sticking it on the refrigerator, some like looking at it online, either or. So I'd like to kind of have both available. So that's really good. Good
to know. Pauline, the documents that I sent over, those are all PDF. Yep. I have printed versions of those and I have them in 4 languages.
Oh,
Spanish, Korean, Vietnamese, and English. So if you want these, contact my email, contact me, give me a call, let me know, and let me know what you want. How many do you want? Where do you want them to be? Where do you want us to send them or deliver them?
Got it.
And same for anybody in your organization. I know we just recently sent 500 copies of
Answers Magazine.
Answers Guide.
Yes. That's what I was thinking of.
There is a little fraud section in there that's updated. And now I edited that whole thing. I'm the co-editor for the magazine too. There is a fraud section in there, but some things change pretty quickly, actually. Believe it or not, the federal government sites actually do change and they do get a little bit better over time.
So wow.
I can I was quite impressed. I'll tell you, when I found the Money Smart stuff and I found the new FTC had changed their link and they have a ton of information, I was just, my heart just popped out of my chest. I thought, oh my goodness, this is wonderful. If anybody that needs this information, please let me know. We have a ton of it. And it doesn't do any good sitting in my closet. It does a lot more good out there in the hands of the people that need it.
Absolutely. Thanks, Karen. Appreciate that.
Thank you all so much. I so enjoyed meeting everybody. If anybody has a question, please feel free. Call me, email me. I'll do everything I can to help you.
Thanks,
Karen.
Thank
you again, Karen. Great presentation.
Y'all have a great week.
Bye. You too.
Hey, I don't know how we top that. So we may just adjourn the meeting. Just kidding. the next item on here is chair items, old business, new business. I have nothing for this topic unless I've missed something, Desiree.
No, I don't believe you added anything to that section.
I'm going to move to the subcommittee report. Dave is not here to do the digital divide. Elizabeth, is there something you would like to report on elder abuse as a result of the elder abuse subcommittee?
No. But this presentation today was outstanding. And this really needs to go to the entire SCAC. This was outstanding. But there is something I want to bring up. Maybe it should have been under new business, or maybe it should be under announcements, roundtable discussion, and that is future meetings. I think it's that having meetings like this makes sense. Driving to Santa Ana does not make sense. And I would like to propose that our future committee meetings be online like this, on Zoom. I find these extremely productive and see no reason why we need to meet in person.
I'll second that motion.
Was that a motion or is that just discussion?
It was a suggestion, but yes. I will make a motion. I can do that. I move that we have
Elizabeth, let's do that at the at the round table or something like, because it's not an agenda item.
Right.
I don't know
that we can could it be a motion under new business?
Okay, but there is no, it has to be on the agenda in order to make a motion and vote on it. So what I'm going to do is we're going to discuss it and we're going to put it on the agenda next time. But I don't think there's an opportunity for us to add something to the agenda. That would violate the Brown Act, I believe. So if Elaine or someone else wants to correct me, please, or Pauline.
No, you're absolutely correct. The committee cannot take action on any item that is not on the agenda.
But we will come back to that to discuss it, because I know this is a issue for a number of people. So I will come back to that in just a few minutes. I just want to work my way through the agenda. And again, there is no report for the digital divide nor elder abuse. So I'm now moving to ledge tracking. And what I'm going to try to do is demonstrate my Zoom skills here and see if I can bring up on the share screen what Janice has put together. But I may be so technology challenged that I'm not able to do that. I'm not seeing it.
John, if you have it, roll over the bottom of your screen. I think, is it bottom? Hold on. Desiree, can he share a screen? Can you give him permissions to share a screen?
Yes, all panelists have ability to share screen.
Okay, so if you roll over the bottom of your screen, John, there should be a button that says share screen with an arrow going up. Do you see it?
Uh-huh. Okay, cool. I'm just trying to, the more difficult thing is trying to
which
find
screen, the screen you want to share.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So hold on just a minute. Bear with me just a second.
Sure.
Okay, so I've cleaned out Word, so let's see if it shows up. Here we go. Thank you for your patience. You should all be seeing document legislative report, February 24th, 2023. This is what we will be distributing to CSL members. This is what we have sent to Justice in Aging. Justice in Aging compiles a report of the legislative bills that are impacting seniors in the 2023 legislative session. There is a much more comprehensive document from CDA that has over 50 bills, but our review is that that at times is more of a tracking device for CDA to ensure that they don't overlook any legislation. Doesn't necessarily directly impact. It may have some impact. So this is what we are submitting. And so again, I will give this to Desiree to distribute to the Senior Citizen Engagement Committee. Remember, our intent is that this is a one-time publication that you're able to go to Ledge info. So under status, where my cursor is, if you click on that, that takes you to Ledge info and you've got the latest information on the status of that bill rather than waiting for Janice to publish this on a monthly basis. And it may be already outdated by the time you get it. So this is real time information. So I'm just going to scroll through. So this is the grandparent issue we talked about last month. This is going to be a resolution, basically tying in with Senior Rally Day on May 2nd. So they'll identify the week and Senior Rally Day will fall within that week. And there will be an acknowledgement to that, and ageism will be a topic of discussion at Senior Rally Day as well. Okay, so I will be sending this to everyone. Are there any questions before I stop share screen? So in the future, I will produce a document from Justice and Aging that will be a somewhat similar format that lists the bill number, the author, the summary, and it will also identify it by the master plan for aging. We will do that with this as well. We had a deadline of Friday, and not every bill that had been picked up had a bill number yet, or they may just be a spot bill, which is basically they're just a, it's just a shell. Okay, they've got a, they don't have all of the wording yet. So that, for example, is seen in SB 535 at the bottom where that is blank. Okay. Okay. So we're back. Let me go to the agenda. I don't have anything for item 10, new members. Elizabeth, we're now at item 11, where we do a give an opportunity for each member to speak before we adjourn. I turn the floor over to you, Elizabeth, to again restate your issue.
I would suggest that, first of all, I believe all of us think that it is unnecessary to travel to Santa Ana to have these meetings. We can do it beautifully right here as we have been. And so I would like to suggest that in the future that the meetings be on Zoom, that these meetings be on Zoom.
You're talking about just committee meetings, right?
Just the committee right.
meeting. Mm-hmm. More specifically.
Meeting, that's what I'm talking about. Not some other committee meeting.
Right.
This one.
Right.
I just want to chime in. After tomorrow, Elizabeth, I hear what you're saying. And yes, I agree with you. It would be much nicer to continue these. But we have no legal authority to do that going forward because the emergency declaration will end as of tomorrow, effective tomorrow. So we've had this conversation many, many times with County Council, and it's their recommendation that the meetings go back to full-time in-person versus a hybrid with some committee meetings versus in Zoom and some committee meetings in-person. So I'm happy to talk to them again about it, but that has been their consensus all along on this one.
Well, would you? Because all of us, I think that this is perfectly good. There is no need to travel.
So I understand.
Why would you want to do that?
I hear you loud and clear. I understand, but you also have to keep in mind.
Isn't it a violation of the Brown Act to do this?
I'm not going to answer that right now because I'm not sure. I'll have to double check on that one. But no, I'm not sure the Brown Act comes into play. But I will tell you that the Board of Supervisors has 82 boards, commissions, and committees that it deals with. And if you have one committee, it's not only a question of the state emergency declaration going away, it's also going to be, now that we are post-COVID environment, resources for being able to accommodate like both. And it's from County Council's perspective, they're telling us that no, it's back to normal because there's no reason why you should not meet in a normal meeting setting anymore. But I will double check for you, Elizabeth.
And also, would you double check, because I emailed the chair of the Housing and Transportation Committee asking her if she would put it on her agenda that we do this, that the housing...
You can have a discussion on it. There's no problem having a discussion on it, but you're not going to be able to take any action on it because there's no legal authority for you to do so.
So you can talk all you like, but you're wasting your breath.
At this point, unless County Council tells me differently, yes, that would be the case, unfortunately. But let me double check with County Council. Let me do my due diligence on my end. Let me double check for you. And I'll let the group know.
So it would also include housing and transportation as well.
It would be applicable to all subcommittees across the board.
Thank you.
Are there any other announcements to be made at this time? And Pauline, just so we don't get in the crosshairs, February 28th also applies to Bagley Keene. And we're waiting to see if anybody's going to make a pronouncement or whether it just disappears. But because Bagley Keene, the provisions were extended into July, but there is, again, what's interesting is when no one wants to make a decision, it just sits there. But I'm speaking to the state at this time,
yeah.
Certainly
yeah.
not the county. Okay.
Right. I should hope not, John.
We're unable to get an answer, but what we would be, we believe, afforded the opportunity. So if we do this, I don't want to get the CSL members to be using this as a leverage piece for the county. But
I got you.
CSL has in the past, because of the commuting, because of the travel expenses to bring 20 people to a meeting, we were allowed to conduct, in effect, conference calls before Zoom. We were able to utilize Zoom, but you had to have a public location.
The Brown Act does allow for that. It does allow if you have one member of a city council or if you have, who's out of town and wants to participate. But there are certain rules and regulations that apply with that. As you said, like the posting of the agenda, people have to have access to the location where you're at, and all that. I will double check on that when I talk to the attorney, when I talk to George.
So I just wanted to make sure that,
CSL
members, remember, we're governed by the Bagley-Keene Act, not the Brown Act. And it's surprising, but they are different. Okay.
You would think
there are many similarities, but there are also some unique differences as well. And what the state does could theoretically be different than what the city and county does.
Yeah.
And be compliant. So again, I don't want us to be sitting in a situation where we're saying, "Well, we do it this way at CSL." Yes, we may, but it's because of Bagley-Keene, not because we're defying the Brown Act in any way.
Gotcha.
Excuse me. So I'm sure that muddied the water. So I apologize, but
yeah, it's clear as mud, John. Thanks.
Exactly. Exactly. So, and as again, a reminder to people, remember, things are beginning to return to what was. C4A is holding their convention in May in person in Glendale. So as a reminder to Pauline, typically the AAAs have sent SCAC members. Sorry, I've got a frog in my throat. SAC members to the C4A convention, I think it's ranged between 1 and 5. A lot of times people don't want to go. That's an option.
I have looked into that, and that will be I have looked into it at our level, and my understanding is there is enough funding in the budget to send between 1 and 4 people from SCAC to that conference if they're interested in attending. But that's a subject that will have to go before the SCAC board or the executive committee to find out who they want to attend. And then who wants to attend. It's in Glendale, it's not too far away, but still there's travel involved as well. And reservations and registration and all that good stuff.
Yes. Hey, Pauline.
Yeah.
Thank you for your efforts to get up to speed as quickly as you have.
I have to thank Desiree. I really do, because she's been very, very helpful in getting me up to speed on a lot of this. And as I said, I think at one of our other committee meetings there last week, it's delving into this. There is a lot of work involved in managing all of these committees. And I am grateful to Desiree for her work in doing that. She's been tremendous. So. And thank you, Desiree.
Yes, kudos to Desiree. I couldn't do this either without her due diligence in keeping me in between the two lanes, okay? And not wandering too far astray.
Thank you both.
So we're now at that moment where the gavel is about to go down and adjourn the meeting. If there are no other announcements, I am prepared to adjourn the meeting. Pauline, anything on your end?
I'm good. Thank you.
Wonderful. Okay, folks, thank you very much. I think this has been I'm sorry it took so long, but a really informative meeting about a topic I think that we're all very concerned with, and I hope will give us an opportunity to interact more with the county and even maybe the supervisors on this issue, because it is extremely troubling.
Sure.
And I had no idea the amount of money at a worldwide level these people are bringing in when they're they're second only to two other economies. That's pretty staggering stuff, I'll tell you. Anyway, enough said. Thank you very much. This meeting is adjourned. Have a great day.